Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They absolutely got it right. Here on Liberty Works Radio Network with your host, Tom Navolis, as we take a look at those mirrors of history and how are they relevant for today? Well, I have to tell you, as it has been again, it has been that. A very, very busy week. We have seen a number of different things occurring, and it is interesting that what we're seeing unfolding is an action that is a continuum of time. I have to tell you that I was looking back through some of my namesakes. My character, if you will, Samuel Adams' writings. And it was very interesting to me to find that when he was talking about politics and writing about them and things that were happening, oh, let's say back in 1775, for instance, that, when put your enemy in the wrong and keep him so, is a wise maxim in politics as well as in war. I'm going to kind of go over that a couple of times throughout the program because I think that you could say it falls back even further to Sun Tzu about how you keep your enemies close or how you put them at a disadvantage in regards to always pointing out their faults, their deficiencies. Those types of items. And this is something that was adopted very, very interestingly, and we're not going to get into it. You could go back into another program in the past, or we can look at sometime in the future, is looking at the Hegelian effect and the Hegelian dialect. Now, as you know, Hegel was a philosopher during the 18th century, 18th, 19th century, that kind of transitional time frame. Marx was a student of Hegel. He was a disciple of Hegel. So we know that a lot of the anti-God, anti-Christian, God is dead, came from Hegel. The Hegelian dialect, how to manipulate words, which we're seeing a lot of, and to the extent that Marx, Engels, and the communists have perfected that methodology in turning the definitions of words into something else. I recently saw on Facebook is where Google is redefining fascism so that it actually really means you and I, when in fact, if you look at the pure definition of fascism, it's Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and a lot of that ilk, because everybody says, well, they're socialists. I usually call them communist, except that we're in a constitutional republic. So, in effect, the fascism started even further back with Clinton as a president and then was through the continuum, including the Bushes, in that what we had, so I guess it started with Bush 1, right after Reagan, as fascism was really coming into America. And I have to take you back even a step further. Here we go, mirrors of history, ladies and gentlemen. This is not confusion, this is just recollection. If we go all the way back into the 1913s, and remember the book that I told you about, Philip Drew, and that Mr. House wrote that book, Philip Drew, and that was the instigation of American fascism, in that it was a administrator or a group of people acting as administrators, where you would have some inklings of private property and businesses would be regulated in such a manner that in effect they were operated by the determination of the government. Now, we've seen that in these modern times, especially in banking. We've seen that in what happened with the auto industry crash. GM was actually owned and run, if you will, by the federal government for a period of time. So there's a number of different things that not only by some sense of direct control, and I would have to say that the whole environmental insanity, as well as all of the various companies that are being funded through the Department of Energy, that they're government-controlled. So you have a government-controlled industry that is actually in the environmental spaces because, you know, we're funding them out of our tax dollars. So there's a lot of stuff out there that when you really consider what fascism is by its truest definition, it is a form of socialism, a form of socialism, communism, that has operation within the context of a parliamentary, or in our case, a constitutional environment. So to label fascism with the pictures of Nazism, or one of the things they don't do, which is interesting, is Mussolini, who is the real fascist, even far and above and beyond, because, as you know, the Nazis were the Socialist Party of Germany, so you have to use the moniker, if you will, and not the correct term. So the reality is that the Nazis were not fascists, so to equate those terms, again, is the Hegelian dialectic of confusion, and in reality, what you have is Mussolini being the true fascist in the way that he took over Italy, no different than what happened in Egypt during that World War II period of time, and so on and so forth. But back to Adams here for a second. I really took you off track, but I guess I'm frustrated today in that what we're seeing is that that we have these attacks that are happening on us, not just Mr. Trump, President Trump. They're happening on you and I, and this is something that is becoming blatant. And I'll get into it later, but it's really blatant because this has been part of the plan. And with the loss of Hillary, who would have closed the noose around our necks and popped open the trapdoor for anything that would have been of liberty on a constitutional basis, this has thrown a real monkey wrench. And so what we have is the media doing its thing, and then we have the Progressive Caucus. I don't even call them anything else anymore, but the Progressive Caucus that is in the House in particular, some in the Senate, they're not associated, but the House Progressive Caucus is communist, flat out. Nobody wants to say that, but that's what they are. And the reason I can say that is because the Communist Party USA has declared the Democratic Party as its own party. Okay, so those are the types of things that, you know, people are absolutely unaware of. Even the conservative media, except for Lou Dobbs, I really appreciate Lou Dobbs in our modern times. There's the Hannitys and all of the others that are on Fox are very, very, they dance around the issue. They dance around the truth is that what we have allowed is the communists to actually infiltrate every aspect of our governance since the 20s, and now we're battling for our lives for a republic. And we're in a real tight spot, because I'm going to take you back through not just from this historical perspective that Adams predicted it, the Anti-Federalists did, but I will probably spend a little bit more time in recent history, going back into the 60s, 70s, and 80s, maybe touching on the 90s, but that, you know, if we can go back and look at our last 100 years, we can take it very, very clearly back to what Mr. House participation right there in 1910, 1911, and moving it forward with his idea of an administrator. And that's what we had under Obama. We even had that under the Bushes, because what it comes down to, ladies and gentlemen, is why we're doing the Samuel Adams Center for Political Science is that people are policy. It is without question, people are policy. So we have not raised up people that can come to an understanding of a moral and virtuous components of society and of the means of governance to the extent that nobody has the intestinal fortitude to fight. And that kind of was brought up this week on a conference call that I was on. It was very, very interesting is that one of the participants in the call is an appointee in the administration, and that person was saying, you know, talking about conservatives have no stomach, and very few have the capacity to fight within the swamp. Very few have the capacity to take a risk to get out there and say, I will serve my country for a four-year period of time. I'll step away from my means of employment. I'll leave my family, or I'll drag my family for 4 years, maybe eight, into the belly of a beast that stinks, that has stench, that swamp, that drags you into the quagmire, unless you have the capacity to fight. And this is something that really got to me in that I've been saying it for years, that we have emasculated our youth over the last 30 years in particular. We have not taught our youth how to fight. And I'm talking about Christians, pastors, churches. I'm appalled, and I am very, very quiet, and I maintain myself when I go to church a lot of times, but I am appalled by pastors that are willing to accept persecution in America. I'm just appalled at that. They think that that's a direction that obviously we have to go. That's not what our founders intended for America. They intended that when the pilgrims came that this would be a shining city on the hill. The way that our governance came together was so that we would have our religious liberty first. Samuel Adams was very, very, very strong on it. I mean, he got into this whole thing right here in the same letter, and it fits this way, and I'm kind of putting it together, is that when they are pushed by clear necessity for the defense of their liberties to the trial of arms, I trust in God, they will convince their friends and their enemies of their military skills and valor. Got that? And valor. Their constant prayer to God is to prevent such necessity, but they are daily preparing for it. I rejoice with you, sir, in most earnestly wishing for a speedy and full restoration of the rights of America, which are violated with so high an arbitrary hand, and am in behalf of the committee with great respect. This was talking about Boston 75. He encouraged the people, everyone in the churches, to train militarily if they had to. And we're going to pick up with this a little bit later, but the thing is that we have emasculated our youth with all of this psychobabble and everything else that has happened. And it's been the plan of the communists to do that. But they, on the other hand, are arming and training a resistance of communist forces in America. And we're seeing that outlash on university campuses and in the streets. So this is very interesting. And so what we'll do is we're going to have to talk about this. We're going to talk about treaties. We're going to talk about a number of areas that we must take a stand and train our young people again to battle with words and language, as Samuel Adams did when he stood his ground with Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalists. They got it right here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty, it absolutely does work for you. Come on back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalist. They absolutely got it right. Here on Liberty Works Radio Network, where liberty works for you, with your host, Tom Nivolus. And I do want to thank you for being here at Liberty Works Radio Network. And I would ask you to check out, as I do, all of the other hosts and hostesses and what other live programming is on, and that you would take and participate, because as you know, this is a listener-funded network. And we appreciate everything that you're doing to keep this program as well as the network on the air, and contributing to that which is a preservation of liberty. And in that, I just kind of want to segue a bit back to the Boston Under Siege. Boston Under Siege, well, today, all of Massachusetts, Northeast, all the way through the East Coast, and that is not under siege any longer. It has been taken over. It's corrupted. It's destroyed from every foundational truth that our patriot forefathers fought for. Everything that they stood for on morality, virtue, governance, liberty, all of that has been destroyed from Massachusetts through Connecticut into New York, down into New Jersey, down into Maryland, and now we're seeing it moving into Virginia and has moved into Virginia and into the other southern former colonies, first initial 13 states. I say that very clearly because if you look at history in any sense whatsoever, you will see that what has happened because of the socialist slash communist slash liberal slash progressives, the immorality that is there, is that when you go through that process, there's these other process charts out there that, you know, have this whole stuff. Anyway, my whole area on the loss of liberty and the drive to despotism and tyranny is when you lose morality, when you lose what it means to have morality and virtue. So in that, there was in Boston this whole thing that they were suffering because the English came in and took over Boston and put it under siege, even had the blockades, all of that. And during that period of time, you know, you couldn't get food in. They were starving the people inside. They were doing all of these things. You know, many people were able to leave. But it was very, very interesting is that, Virginia took and sent replenishments to Boston. They sent donations of corn, wheat, and bread from Spottsylvania, Spottsylvania, Virginia. And it was sent by Charles Dix, Charles Washington, and George Thornton. And they said that, you know, hey, I hope this is some replenishments that would be useful to you. There was also a note in that from Westmoreland County in Virginia that they sent from a John Augustine Washington, sent more than 1,000 bushels of grain that they furnished. And that's when Sam Adams replied what he did that incorporates what I opened the first segment with, in that they were excited and for all of that was given to them, that here in Boston they're unjustly oppressed, but you know heaven is smiling upon them for the friendship and the support of all North America. The designs of our enemies to oblige them to make this base compliances to the injury of our common cause have been hitherto frustrated. So you see, we have to be able to support one another. And if you don't think that the nation is under siege today, well, it is. People are enslaved by regulation. We're enslaved by what has happened. I looked up And let me go back just for a second, is what we're seeing occur, and this is the Alinsky model. This actually goes back to Lenin and Stalin, which I'll bring up or may bring up in a little bit, is that idea of Adams saying here, put your enemy in the wrong and keep him so, is a wise maxim in politics as well as in war. So that's what we're seeing today in the media. We're seeing that with the progressives in the Congress. We're seeing that all over with these attacks in academia, so on and so forth. And you know what's happening in the media, so you pay attention. And that becomes very, very interesting. But when we look at the attacks, when we look at what we're seeing happening in our present time, we saw that Boston was under siege. And in Boston being under siege, it was cut off, as I said. But here you had a relief mechanism of the people. I think that ties a bit back, and maybe you may think this is a stretch, but I really don't, is the being that last week when we had Dan Johnson here with Tax Revolution Institute talking about how our taxes could be better used and freed up so that, and our money freed up in such a way that we would go back to a compassion and become a compassionate people, in that we would better be able to determine how we would serve the public through giving instead of being taxed and going to a centralized environment where only about, what I think Dan was saying, that 40 cents on the dollar actually gets to anything that is legislated by law for it to get to in any type of relief manner, be it school this or all the other giveaway programs that we have here to so-called sustain people. We have always been a people that sustained people. Can you imagine that? That, you know, here we have in 1775, coming up from Westmoreland County, 1,000 bushels of grain that were sent to Boston. You know, we could do that now, but you know, the way that our laws and regulations and all of that are, you know, how do we feed those people in our own country? And we used to be the breadbasket of the world, but instead, what we've done is we've turned our breadbasket of the world into the ethanol capitals of insanity that don't do anything except suck more tax dollars off of us, more money off of us. To give out as subsidies. So, you know, I look at this stuff and I sit here and I go, wow, it's very, very interesting. You know, Adams kept on going on, and one of the things that it's talking about in his life, that Adams had long since resigned all hopes of conciliation with England, and he knew that the Americans had either to submit unconditionally or to fight. And it was with him only a question of time when the struggle should commence. But he still observed his favorite maxim, keep your enemy in the wrong. Wow. You see, Alinsky had it right about Adams in that many different ways because, again, I can't let it go. This is what we're seeing continuously in the media now, is that our progressive enemies are pulling this actual maxim and turning it upside down on us. And quite frankly, conservatives, if you will, and constitutionalists, if you will, and more importantly, Christians particularly don't know how to fight. They don't understand this maxim. They don't understand what it means to take and stand their ground and have the capacity to argue in an efficient manner so that their point comes across and takes and puts the enemy in their place and turns it so that the enemy is shown to be wrong. Right? We don't do that. And as I mentioned in the first segment, this is what this gentleman in the administration, in one of the bureaucracies in the administration, was talking about, is that people go to Washington, don't know how to fight. We don't know how to fight even at the local level. So that's, you know, again, the purpose of Samuel Adams Center for Political Science, SACPS.org, is to take and be able to allow our young people to become leaders and policymakers that understand morality, values, virtue, the fundamental developments of what our republic is supposed to be, starting with the Declaration of Independence, and even starting before that with the writings of Samuel Adams, and the fact that he was someone that would stand strong on virtuous moral policy for liberty. And he was mentioned over a number of different times, is that he was a person of the people. He was there for the common people. He understood that. And that is what we have to get back to understanding again, is that the truths of our nation follow strictly along, if you allow them, and if you go there, with the very valuable biblical principles of how to take care of one another, how to live out those Ten Commandments, how to stand true and strong on moral and virtue in governance. And it even has to happen in business governance. So this is the type of things that we haven't seen in a long time. How do you stand strong? I hear that a lot of times in Sunday school. Well, you know, I did this or I didn't do that because of my job and this, that, and the other thing. No, what are you willing to stand strong for? And it's not just a persecution of our Christianity. It's a persecution of our nation and the strength of what we are on the fundamental principles of truth. This gets me every time. Don't turn it into a weeny, whiny bunch of nonsense. What we have to be able to do is stand and articulate truth. Stand on truth and be able to communicate in such a manner that the Hegelian dialectic and all of these other methodologies that the communists have perfected in such a way that they try and turn us on our ears, isolate us, and violate our thought. And now what we're seeing is violating our free speech. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the types of things that Soblov wrote about. And he wrote about these even in the 20th Communist Conference. These are the things that Kozak was putting into play. Academia becomes one of the greatest tools of Communist Party USA. I can take you through numerous different things that are well documented to prove that. And through the whole aspect of everything that is going on. And ladies and gentlemen, the idea here is that I'll take you back here through, let's see, what Mr. Steele was saying in his article. And Mr. Steele is one of the people within the Communist Party. And when you take and you look at it back in, somewhere around 1988, Steele says, in the presence of a mass-based third party, it is possible and necessary for the people's movement to make use of the Democratic Party in the struggle for reforms. For the last 50 years, the Democratic Party has housed a broad mix of class and social focuses that are often in conflict with each other. This has been a sharp rise sometimes to subdue them, and sometimes to move the direction. The status and intensity of this struggle depends on the level and strength of the political leaders in the labor movement and other people forces operating inside the party. So what we have and what we see now, and you look at the top of the Democratic Party, they're absolutely communist. You know, the radical Islamist. So what we have is, when we come back, we're going to get into some more of this and that the reality that Sam Adams talked about it. But, you know, keep your enemy in the wrong. That's what they're doing to us. That's what they're doing to the so-called conservatives. So we have to be strong on constitutionalism as we come back when Samuel Adams returns. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns, the Anti-Federalists. Yes, they did. They got it right. They nailed it to the core. And this is Tom Navolis, your host. I have to take you through this whole process of the mirrors of history. I've been rather, my attitude, I guess, or, you know, you choose what your attitude is. My choice and my attitude for today has been somewhat subdued in the fact of frustration around the ability to fight. One of the things that my dad, he taught me that it wasn't a bad thing to defend yourself, and if you had to get in a fight, you better win. You better know how to win. And he taught me the things that I knew during my growing up and age categories on how to win. My dad was, when he was younger, he was a semi-pro boxer, if you will, or he participated, in the boxing sports. He knew a lot from being a Korean veteran in hand-to-hand combat and things like that, and he taught me a lot of basics. And then as I grew older, I engaged and learned how to do that and perfect a number of those from my different life experiences and so on and so forth. I learned how to fight. But I have to admit that in so many ways, I necessarily didn't teach my children how to fight with words, how to stand their ground sufficiently, because I became too soft in my Christianity, if you will. And most recent years in particular, especially over the last 10, 12, 15 years, if you will, I learned again a lesson that I should have maintained in my life, is that you have to fight. And as Americans, we should know how to fight correctly. And that means on truth, on principles, on values, and not give in. But what we did, because that's what our founders did. That's what Sam Adams was talking about. He knew that we were going to have to take and have a stand. He ensured that the people of Boston and the surrounding areas were training militarily every day. And the reason for that was that he received, and they, being those in Boston, received a letter from a friend in England, around London, out of 1775, that was very, very clear in this after the king addressed Parliament. And this friend says to the correspondent, he writes to the colonies, and that is that, but now you are to be left to your own prudence, your own wisdom will tell you, you no longer to depend upon England to help you. I had 20 gentlemen this day call on me and all say, pray write your friends to declare those rebels who will not fight for their country. For there is gone down to Sheerness 78,000 guns and bayonets to be sent to America, to be put into the hands of the Negroes, the Roman Catholics, and the Canadians, and all the wicked men on earth used to subdue the colonies. So here it was, not only the troops that were being sent, but you have to look, 80,000 guns and bayonets being sent to those who they believed would stand up against the rest of the colonies. All the wicked means on earth used to subdue the colonies. I do not write this to alarm you, but you must not any longer be deceived. And we have a lot of deception going on, and the deception that's happening is in the media, and it's happening in the Democrat Party and the other progressive socialist, Alinskyite, Gramsciite groups in America. Oh, I'm talking about academia. And so what it has here, and I'm sorry to move off of that, but that's where our deception's coming from. The letter goes on and says, Orders have now gone out to take up Mr. Hancock, Adams, Williams, Otis, and six of the head men in Boston. I now have a copy of the proceedings before me. My heart aches for Mr. Hancock. Send off expresses immediately that they intend to seize his estate and have his fine house for general, well, we know who general that was, but that was the taking of property right off the bat. You know, other friends were going and dispatching and sending letters off that General Gage was coming, and he was coming with sloops of war. He has royal proclamations declaring the inhabitants of Massachusetts Bay and some others in different colonies actual rebels, with the blank commission to try and execute such of them as he can get hold of. I do not know them all, but Mr. Samuel Adams, John Adams, Robert Treat Paine, and John Hancock of Massachusetts Bay, John Dickinson of Philadelphia, Peyton Randolph of Virginia, and Henry Middleton of South Carolina are particularly named with many others. This blacklist the general will no doubt keep to himself, but unfold it gradually as he finds it convenient. So here you have a blacklist. So a blacklist, you know, that's been around for a long time, and that idea of a blacklist. Ladies and gentlemen, when it really comes down to all of what is going on, we know that these activities have been happening for a long period of time. And I got to tell you, I kind of teased you a little bit about the treaty stuff. I'm not going to be able to get into that today. We're going to run out of time ultimately, and it needs a whole nother program of itself. There are some programs about treaties in the archives, so I'd ask you to go to SamuelAdamsReturns.net is where the archives are. So if you go there to SamuelAdamsReturns.net, you can get to the archives of a number of the programs. I don't have everything up of the last several years, but there's a good amount of the programs there. And as we continue this whole idea of the unwillingness of people to fight for what they believe they have been, and when I use the term emasculated, I'm using it not as the modern term and where it's been redefined by, again, the progressives, in that it means, oh, to be less like a man. No, I mean where it talks about having your testicles cut off before you were drawn and quartered and hanged. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. And so I mean that in that original sense of the terminology and the original definition relative to this period in history is that, yes, the modern men, and Christian men in particular, have been emasculated because we don't see them standing up for anything. We don't see them standing up for their values, their morals, their truths, whereas the enemy has been doing what? The enemy has been doing exactly what Samuel Adams said should happen to the enemy, and that being, I'll remind you again, is keep your enemy in the wrong. So they've been doing that with us. And that's exactly, if you go and you read Sublov, some of the translation on his attacks on capitalism and what they did at the 20th Communist Congress, they talk about that very, very clearly, is that they have to take and undermine every aspect of those that would stand up and fight for liberty. And to the extent then that they would also take and organize people to fight. And fighting in the sense that they, at a period of time when they needed to, that using violence was okay. So this is some of the things that you have to understand when we see what's going on in the college campuses. And that they would take and grab on to academia, intellectuals. They would grab onto them in such a manner that that would be where they would point people in the wrong direction, as well as what Sam Adams was saying. You know, you keep your enemy in the wrong. And so they keep saying, we're wrong, we're this, we're that, we're fascist, all of these different things, manipulating the definitions of terminology, utilizing the Hegelian methodology and dialectic to turn the evil that they are and that communism is and socialism is and turn it around on us and call us all of the evils and say that we are doing all of the evils that they themselves are. And it's proven. Just look at Venezuela. You know, I've told you folks before that I've been to Venezuela. I was there for business reasons and various things. And Venezuela, we can see it very, very clearly. As the people are standing up, Venezuela has had repression. They've taken and eliminated their political opposition, and now they're turning the police out. But more so, what are they doing? They are arming those that would side with the communists there in Venezuela. They're arming them to go against their own people. Now, this is when you take away, and what I said before, when the morality, more than anything else, when you go through these, what happens in the cycle of a nation and how do they go from liberty back to despotism and tyranny and all of this other academic nonsense. No, the reality of it is that it was the first great awakening that helped solidify for we the people an understanding that there is no king, as the battle cry of what? The battle cry of Connecticut, the battle cry of Vermont, the battle cry throughout most of New England was no king but King Jesus. That's the source of liberty. And that's the source that we can formulate morality. And that's the source of what we have as personal as well as public virtue. That's the source of understanding that if you cannot govern yourself, then no government will be able to do anything except become totalitarian. And when I was doing this study on what it meant to have energy and why that was such a debatable item, it comes down to that from a totalitarian perspective. And that is what the Anti-Federalist argued continuously on, is by giving the federal government too much capacity to legislate and enforce that legislation through bureaucracy and everything else that I've taken you through in Brutus 9 through 12, all the way, ladies, down to your toilets and men into your refrigerators for your beer or your home bar or whatever, you know, even to your barber shop. You know, barbers are regulated like crazy, and hairstylists and beauty shops. Oh, yeah, you know. So here it is. You have this impediment of government that is restricting the liberties by which the founders never intended. Even the Federalist said, oh, no, none of that would really happen, with their expectation, as I always say, the Federalists always expected that the churches would do their jobs and pastors would be that of the Reformation and of the Great Awakenings, and that people would be immoral and religious people. You know, we're going to have to close up with this idea that, you know, John Adams, James Madison, and others said that the Constitution is no good, is non-functional, and I'm elaborating, without a moral and virtuous people. So we don't have that. And then what we don't have is the ability of those that call themselves Christians, who understand that liberty is in Jesus Christ, as we understood during the Great Awakening, they're emasculated. You know, we've gone through this tolerance thing and all of these other things and don't know how to fight. I think it's time that we learn how to utilize language and fight again and put it back on our enemies, on who they are. And we finish up with what Samuel Adams was very, 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 very clearly saying: keep your enemy in the wrong, because they are the progressives, communists, Alinskyites are in the wrong. So come on back next week when Samuel Adams returns because the Anti-Federalists, they got it right.